ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free.
The Herald of Truth broadcast is on the air, a program of spirit and truth dedicated to teaching the way of God more perfectly. These broadcasts contain keys to help unlock knowledge and reveal hidden truths of the Bible in these last days. Christians called to a higher level of understanding will be given Bible-based solutions to their personal as well as national problems. They will want to find out more about their part in God's plan. Our mailing address is Kingdom Identity Ministries, Post Office Box 1021, Harrison, Arkansas 72602, and will be given again at the end of this broadcast.
Turn tonight to the subject of America, which has its place in prophecy, place in ancient history, in Bible history, and in our time, both ancient, modern, and of course the endless tomorrows which God has in store. We're not working out of the dark because we have not only the Word of God with its related references, we have the great panorama of the record of history which men have left. Archaeological records that date back for thousands of years. And this great age in which we live, in which modern science and technology, moving out of the areas of inspiration among thy people, the Most High God, among your race, has not only been able to measure and to understand and now to probe, but the whole ancient story is coming together of the history of the earth and of the nations that have existed upon its varied continents. When we talk about this great nation, we are faced with the fact that our heritage is upon a land which is very old and very ancient, even as it relates to human habitation. But when we talk about the antiquity of this continent as it relates to human occupation, it's one of the oldest spots on the face of the earth that have been inhabited by civilizations and cultures. So we start out when we talk about ancient America by going back to the depth of its antiquity. We know that ancient writers in Greece knew about and had traditions and history concerning a land that was beyond the land beneath the waters. And thus, among some of the great philosophers and writers of ancient Greece, they talked about this continent beyond the continent of Saturn. The Saturnian continent was Atlantis, and they speak about it, in which they tell exactly about the antiquity of that continent and of its time. And they even told Solon in his day how long ago it was that this continent had gone down and left the waters between their land and the great land that was to the westward, now beyond the waters, beyond the land of the Saturnian continent, as they like to call it. Now these United States today, resting in North America, tied to South America with the Central American link, are a part, of course, of a territory so old that among the oldest links we have today can be found when we probe the depths of its surface. When our oil well drillings in Montana are down in Four Corners near New Mexico, drilling below the Precambrian formations, come up with the artifacts of the dwellers that have been upon this continent. And they are ceramics, and some of them are painted, and they have not only plants and creatures upon them, but the paintings and the ceramics and the particles of them are good. And also we have artifacts, and these artifacts coming up, some of them are most interesting instruments because they have, some of them been spearheads, some of them have been arrowheads, some of them very delicately formed. We have also brought up pieces of metal that have been formed as instruments of various kinds. And among them, of course, is the historical gear that comes from great depths below the Precambrian uplifts of Montana and demonstrates that this gear, with its great fulcrum-like lever on the side, lifting apparently made on the gear like any such attachment would be on a gear of our time for the lifting of some piece of machinery for a special purpose. Now, it came out of an oil well core. It's existed today. It's not deformed. There's nothing apart about it that is not in good shape. It proves that in the days before the Precambrian seas washed across that part of Montana, that there were intelligent beings that had machinery. Now, this, my friends, is a long period to estimate. We can no longer tell because we run out of radiocarbon activity. We run out of the ability to determine in the materials beneath it how old this might be. Geology has, by striations, set, of course, as we have in both Grand Canyon and up in the mountains of the Yellowstone, tremendous layers of measure of the stratification, and we can well establish 600,000 years, 800,000 years, and of course in the Grand Canyon there's places where we have over 1 million years of stratification. More than this, ancient measures, of course, that have been used for computing the formations of substance and substratifications have given them periods well beyond millions of years ago. Of course, there are those geologists who completely, with absolute authority, tell us that the Precambrian seas washed the earth 1,500,000,000 years ago, but they've never quite satisfied me that they knew accurately how to determine time elements at such distance. But we are going to settle for the fact that there's no question about the fact of the Precambrian seas washing the earth in this part of it, the Precambrian formations being well over 1 million years old. And well over 1 million years ago, intelligent people on this continent left the bronze gear. And if we could get down there and dig around where it came up, we'd probably find a whole lot of things in that particular layer. But we point out that this shows that there were people upon this very continent we live on ages and ages ago. Now, of course, there have been a lot of work recently done, such as the gathering together of the work of specialists concerning the peoples that we know as Indians, or were called Indians, from Columbus era to our time. And also the work that has been done from the days of Niven on down to the work of a great number of the modern archaeologists concerning Central America and South America, and, of course, the history which we have of America since the coming of the white man. Among those volumes are such books as those put out by Chicago University talking about Indians before Columbus. Even the National Geographic Society's most colorful volume on the Indians, and they go back to the Incas and deal much with the Incan and pre-Incan civilization. And when we talk about the Incas, I think it's important for you to know that 15,000 years ago, the great cities of Tahuantinsuyo and others were formed, and at the time they were built, these cities were not high up in the Andes Mountains. They were just a little above sea level, and this is evidenced by surrounding terrain and territory, and in the low hills, not too far, or shall we say the lower hills from the high summits of the Andes, are seashells and sand, showing that this was elevated at great heights. In fact, this cities, some of which were later occupied by the Incas, were elevated to the heights they hold about 11 to 14,000 years ago. So you get a little bit of how old cities were in South America. And we know that since World War II, as radiocarbon has been put to the debris of some of these cities, which as the mountains went up and the last great mountain uplifts were about 11,500 to 12,000 years ago, that as these uplifts went up, they covered part of the buildings and cities beneath them and have left sheer walls of mighty granite and great uplifts with part of a city below and part on top. And radiocarbon checks out pieces of wooden furniture and materials buried in the city. And we come up with 11,000 years ago, 11,200 and so forth, showing change of events in the mighty uplifts that took place, the antiquity of the furniture, the time when it was, when the catastrophes and upheavals took place. So it is that we know more about these areas than any previous period in time and history. And so long before your race was upon this earth, long before the days of Adam, which history we can set at 7400 B.C. approximately is the time of the Exodus, why this continent had a thriving civilization upon it. We're often very prone to say, well, of course, this civilization was one of savages, and the savages that roamed the world were the ones that existed in that time. But I'm inclined to think, with the great German archaeologist and anthropologist Baron Humboldt, that this is not so. That he was studying carefully the natives of the headwaters of the Orinoco and the Amazon, and some of the strange curios that they possessed, and ancient treasures which they seemed to have hoarded, but were not of their own making. And also a study of these peoples in the areas of the background of their race. And Baron Humboldt was to say, it is quite obvious, he said, that savages are not where they start. They start from civilizations and cultures that catastrophes upset and destroy, or struggles and wars set adrift. and they have to roam away from these centers, and they lack the equipment or the technicians with them that once prepared or produced the things which made their society. And savages are a degeneration which is the outcome of a destroyed civilization and of ancient catastrophe. He says savages are not evolving. Savages are degenerating from the periods of high civilization that had preceded their savagery and being cut adrift. He talks about his studies as how he has studied all areas of savage tribes and groups that he could get to, though there are many unexplored areas in South America as well. And in this instance, the opinion seems to be of the great number of experts who studied Indian background and tradition, and who studied the migrations of peoples upon this planet, that at one time they had ancient civilizations from whence they had been cut adrift. And in the instance of catastrophes or upheavals, they had gone into what we call nomadic savagery. Now, there's a lot that seems to be quite true about this, because there is no way to study the history of this continent without studying the fact that there was a continent to the east of it and a continent to the west of it. And some of its ancient peoples were residues of peoples from these continents, and thus have their records and their indications of this in their own ancient history. Also, we know that there were land bridges left after the sinking of the land masses to the west that were across Bering Strait, and almost the last of those are gone, except for two major islands up there in the straits today. And when we discuss this bridge, we discover that migrations have been attributed for years, are still attributed to the fact that before this land bridge broke, why some of the peoples from Asia crossed across into Alaska and down into North America, and this helped to make up the migrations of its ancient history. I think it rather interesting that we can now come rather scientifically to a time period for the antiquity of some of the civilizations and history of ancient America. Because in the instances of the records, we can go back to both ancient time records as well as the findings of modern science today. For instance, there seems to be a complete record from both the islands of Japan as well as from Asia concerning the fact that the land that was called to the west was largely called Mu, and the rulers of it were called Ramu, and that the land was the land of the God of the universe and of the light of the world. And that Mu was called the land of the sun, and it was once known as the great land of the God of light, and the peoples of India called it the land from that Indra had established, and Indra was the way they named the great God over all white men from who were his children and who were the Aryans that came into their land. In their own Vedic writings, writing later, talked about the fact that the great land where now the Pacific Ocean is was once the land of Indra's Ramu, or kings of Indra ruling the earth. More than that, we note that in some of the areas of the various isles that we have today, why they talk about this land is also being Panmu, and they refer to the fact that one of the later gods who came was the god Pan. That there was a great struggle and mighty wars, and the peoples were torn between the worship of the god of light and of this great new dragon god and of all of his orders. And strangely enough, the violations of divine law, the mongrelization and mutations, and the brutishness that was involved produced a god called the goat gods, the minotaurs, the half-man, half-beast gods of bestiality and evil, and with them comes the word Pan, and the continent becomes known to the westward of these United States today, that's now beneath the waters of the ocean, by the name of the land of the Pan gods, though the word Mu still stands out. The word Yah-Pan meant God Pan, and it was one of the high points, like Easter Island and other islands of the Pacific, that remained above the surface of the waters of the oceans when that continent went down. Now, I think it rather significant, for I'm going to turn here for several pieces of evidence, for instance, in this matter. For instance, we find here that in the records that go back to the Toronto manuscripts, which are some of the oldest manuscripts we have, and they've been unearthed in Maya civilizations, and they have been translated, and inside of this civilization, it talks very plainly concerning this great land and how the fire broke out of its mountains and how it rocked and split and how it fell beneath the waves and how they used to travel across this continent to far lands and of the lands that were there, and how they also were a part of the great lands of the Ramus, or the king of this land. In this great manuscript, it tells about how the volcanoes were set in operation because of the anger of the gods, and then how the land broke up and the water rushed in and the great catastrophes, and how that continent went down into the lake of fire and into the pits. And of course, actually, what they saw was the volcanic eruptions, the great catastrophes that swallowed it up. We point out that in the records concerning the time element that is involved in this, that we have a rather interesting record for way back when Shilaman over in Troy was unearthing the great and ancient areas of Troy. He found records there that referred, of course, to Atlantis and referred to the lands that had gone down beneath the water from whence had come the Egyptians and other peoples. And so in these records, the record of the Troano manuscript of ancient Mayas of the Yucatan estimated to be now about 3,000 years old, as the carbon tests of the manuscript would produce. And the extracts of this manuscript tell about how the land was sacrificed and how it went down, and the numbers of the peoples that it gives are about 64 million that went down at that time. I think it also interesting that the dates of the dynasties of that civilization that went down were about 50,000 years ago. Now, that doesn't mean that that's when the land was born. We have 200,000 years of civilization that existed connected with those old civilizations and North and South America and Central America. Just out of Mexico City, within 21 miles, it was even was the archaeologist who was the one that found the levels of three different civilizations, and each one of them, as they went down and discovered these civilizations and remnants of its temples and its peoples, and the end of radiocarbon dating measure and chlorine replacement and the stratification factors that are involved would demonstrate that the lava patterns that helped to cover them and the time element of the catastrophe would show without doubt that 200,000 years ago there were cities that were built with architecture and there were temples and there were peoples living in Mexico. So this happens to be one of the oldest pieces of recorded construction and buildings that had civilization in the United States. In tracing back the history, as the National Geographic's late volume shows, with the use of radiocarbon and carbon replacement, fluorine replacement, they have proven that they have dug up Indians, their fossils and their fossil bodies, and they have classified some of them as Mongols, and they have classified some of them as not being Mongols at later periods, but they go back 39,000 years. So we have American Indians living in sort of tribal life, but having also implements which demonstrated that they must have had some areas of trade with higher civilizations, because buried with these Indians at a date going back between the 30,000 year point and 39,000 years have been implements made of metal, and implements which also show that if they did not have the processes to make them, they knew where to trade to get them. Now, I think it rather significant that in the dating, for instance, of the areas of this continent that has subsided to the westward, we point out that both Japan as well as China have dates in their history for this. They, in Japan, have the dynasties of the land that plunged beneath the water as having existed 18,000 years for the late dynasties of which Japan was a part and which they, the Sumare, came from. And so the Sumare warriors in Japan talk about the dynasties of their kings and of their particular families that were destroyed by the great catastrophe and the fire and the earth and upheaval, which left just their islands above the water as being dynasties 18,000 years ago at the time of the catastrophe. This is rather a significant thing, since also we have the history that is recorded by the peoples of ancient China. The Qin dynasties talk about the fact that their motherland had gone down beneath the waters and that they had built new civilizations to the northward. We haven't time to go into all the facets of that tonight, but I want to point out that here, according to the measure of the peoples that were involved, the great number of the peoples that had existed in this A particular continent came from the continent that went down to the west, while others of them had come from the continent that went down to the east, and in the history and the record and way up 15,000 feet in the air, in the highest of the mountain ranges, is the record, however, of the great catastrophe that had enveloped the continent to the east and the catastrophe that enveloped the continent to the west. Now, the history, in order to tell what happened to the continent of the east, had to be written 11,500 years ago, because it's been 11,500 years ago, according to both ancient Greek as well as ancient Egyptian history, since the descent of Atlantis. In fact, if I wanted to take the time tonight, I could give you a chronological absolute measure of history, which shows how many years back and to a certain king and how many years forward to now, that proves when that land went down. And, of course, the patterns of the radiocarbon tests on furniture buried by the great upheaval as the mountains went up at that particular time prove that this is so. There are great numbers of emblems, and significantly, the one thing we find about the most ancient peoples in this continent was that they worshipped one god out of the center of the universe, and they believed that he was master of the earth, that he was a god of light, and they understood this much of the same theology you did. They had the symbol that he was the god of spirit, soul, and body, and lived in three dimensions, or could. They not only knew that he had a children, which were the children of light, but they knew that they were children of the spirit, and that at times they could appear, and other times they were not visible. This was all in their ancient tradition. And so in the background of these peoples, of the ancient lands, they built cities, they worshiped one god, and the catastrophe that destroyed their civilizations comes with a Luciferian rebellion that fits into biblical history and the great contest for the thoughts of man, and the resulting situation was that there descends upon them immorality, corruption, degeneration, mongrelization, integration, and the end. And in the judgments which fell, there is a complete testimony, both by archaeology, by the remnants of the peoples that are found on these various islands, by long chains of connections and their emblems, the background theology of their religion. And one of the things we point out is that the High Incas that lived in Incan civilization have lived upon lands and temples that were built ages before them. They made some modifications, they adopted to their own use, but they couldn't overthrow or disturb the writings and the history that was so much before them. And of course, it wasn't just the hieroglyphics or even their own later crude writing above it, but it was the record in great flowing historical patterns that can be translated and understood today. And of course, if one knows the background of the ancient Book of the Dead, one understands that the great amount of this story was the story of things that had happened as whole continents went down. It was a sort of memorial for the peoples that died in the catastrophes, but it was a story of how they had migrated and how they moved and what their destiny was to be. And involved in it, of course, are certain things of history that run right up until a modern time or to the time of the Adamic race and the coming of the white man again. But the instances of these things are interwoven, and they're the history of dynasties that are ancient as well as contemporary with later Egyptian history. Menthos, the high priest of Egypt, talks about the sinking of the great continent that was to the eastward of what we now call the United States, and how the peoples of ancient Egypt had migrated from this, and how they had found themselves finally settling in the great Fertile Crescent after crossing the lands of Africa, then rich and flowing with grass and trees, which are now desert, showing the transitions that have happened in that period of time. Coming up to more relatively contemporary periods, we find out that in the periods of the last few thousand years, the history, which is closer, of course, to the events of our time, become quite important. The Mayas, whose civilization in the Yucatan built these great temples and mighty altars, and who had a knowledge found today of almost all the biblical record of everything that had happened in Bible tradition from the days of Adam and the struggle of the Luciferian serpent, who was also in their background, right on down to the periods of the kings of Israel. It's a rather interesting thing to note. How did they get them? Well, among them were the Quiches. Who were the Quiches? Well, they were tall white men that came, that arrived in great birds that sailed the sea. In other words, the ships of the Phoenicians, which of course were the ships of Dan, had carried across the waters, across the ocean, in the periods of about 800 to 760 B.C., a part of the tribe of Manasseh, which the Bible tells us went to sea in ships. And they went to sea in the ships of Dan, and they sailed into the Caribbean Sea, and they entered into the areas of Central America, and here the Maya, which were not warlike, except in the gathering of the victims for their sacrifices that were round about, and actually this was obtained without any military operation. The high priest of ancient Mayan theology, now worshiping the serpent forms and the powers of darkness, formed and had human sacrifices, and whereas otherwise they were a sort of quiet people with an ancient culture and art and remembering things out of an ancient Antediluvian background. But when the white man came, they thought these men were the very gods. They received them as the sons of the ancient gods of space, and they listened to them, and the impact that the Manasseh people had, which were your kinsmen and relatives of your own race, had upon them, was to get them to turn, partially anyhow, to the worship of eternal God, or the God you know as our Father, Yahweh the Eternal. And so in this instance, they added to their history all the things that these white men taught them that brought them up to date, from the Adamic race right on down through the events that transpired, even the events of the Exodus, and right on into the period of some 1400 years before Christ. They have these events inside of areas of their history. More than this, we have other rather interesting things connected with this. Down in right of the Toltec civilizations, which were also relatively high in architecture and knowledge in Central America, and also in southern Mexico, had this knowledge. Strange it may seem, there was built up by the influence of these white men, whose influence over the Maya became quite strong. They would not intermarry with the Maya. They retained their old and ancient tradition of segregation. However, there was a very light group of Maya. They were called the White Maya. They were rulers. They produced a large part of the priesthood, which had been a part of the ancient civilization, but they were not the Caucasian type, even though they were called the White Maya. There was no fusing to speak of the blood of these sons of Manasseh with these peoples of the Maya, but they did multiply, and they did increase, and they did rule over the peoples of the land, soon accepted as the great and mighty representatives of the God of the deep blue sky. Now, it's rather interesting that the Aztecs, I want you to know that students of archaeology know that the Aztecs did not build the Aztec cities. The Aztecs of Mexico and the remnants of those Aztecs as we have them today were not the builders of the great Aztec cities. There are practically no tribes of Mexican Indians today that do not find themselves mixed up with Mongol and Tartar blood. In fact, there is existed in the histories of the ancient Mayas and in the Aztecs their battles. And prior to the present Aztec, which was fused with Tartar blood, there had existed those that built the old cities that we call the Aztec cities. And between the creation of those old Aztec cities and their pyramid temples and their symbols of initiation, there had come a wave of Mongols, though this particular group were Chinamen of not high stature. These came across America in great numbers. They had crossed apparently from the upper areas of the Bering Strait, and they came down in the relatively later periods of history. They not only had waged a war, but for a time they apparently had conquered among the Aztec cities. And then a wave of the leadership of white-led tribes and peoples overthrew them. They unearthed in Mexico, just out of Mexico City, in one of the temples which they unearthed, which had been a part of this period, not only warriors that were not of great height, but when they examined these warriors, they were Chinamen. They were true Chinamen, true Mongols. And they had on them necklaces and armbands of pure green jade. Now, the green jade which they had was strictly Chinese jade. It wasn't like the deep, high green jade that's found along the coasts of California that have washed across on the bottoms of the oceans, rolled and tumbled on our beaches. It wasn't the type of jade that has been found anywhere in America when examined by the experts. It was Asiatic Chinese jade. And these warriors had weapons and the remnants of of what they had left, and those that were buried in this catastrophe that had buried this city demonstrated that for a while some of the artisans here were of Chinese type and origin. Across the steppes of Asia and across the Bering Strait, there came waves of the Mongol warriors. These Mongol warriors and were in themselves high-cheekbone, high-step peoples of the ancient Tungus society. The ancient cities of the Tungus civilization, the Tungus man and the Turanian man had been scattered, of course, from the high steppes of Asia down into Mesopotamia. It was to lay the groundwork for the Assyrian peoples, which emerged out of them. And, of course, in this continent, moved around in warlike bands. And some of them had actually built cities. And among these cities were cities that had been built in the areas of the northern parts of California and up into Oregon, where they had set up with the exact same formation, the same type of yurt huts that they used to have up in the Siberian mountains and in the great steppes of Asia, only now where they thatched them with mud and they thatched them with brush. But here we find whole mounds with the remnants of these Asiatic warriors, their symbols, their jewelry, their materials showing that they had come out of Asia. We note that among the peoples that make up America, we have the Indian tribes that were here in the days of Columbus and in the days when Cortez made his historic and famous march across the southern portions of the United States and into Mexico and eventually down to the land of the Incas. Nothing is more interesting to the student of ancient America than to read the records of the priests that traveled with him trying to make converts out of these people, whose diaries are among some of the most important records of early America. In fact, we have in my own library, I have the diary of one of these Spanish priests, and it's the whole diary of a conquistador and his whole company crossing America and going all the way down deep into the Andes Mountains. And one of the things they were looking for were, of course, the seven great cities of Cibola, seven cities in New Mexico that were built by white rulers that rule over ancient Aztec civilizations. And they had built these cities, and the cities held great treasures of gold. They were well known in the ancient world, and the traditions were 300 years older than the time of Cortez as to when the visitors had been there and how their forebears had told the stories. And Cortez pushed forward to them. Actually, a volcanic eruption that took place down in Lincoln County covered these cities over with tremendous layers of volcanic material. And this is why when Cortez arrived, he never was able to find these cities. They are buried beneath layers of volcanic ash and eruption that took place in that period of time. So about 600 years ago or thereabouts, these great seven cities of civilization that have been described by Indian civilizations and cultures and records and traditions all around went down. Of course, this isn't to be looked down upon as too unusual, because a great mountain chain that extended from the Great Lakes down to Mexico, down to Oklahoma City, went down during the days of the Clark Expedition, was swallowed up in great and quivering earthquakes that were almost unequaled, that threw everybody in the Clark party at the floor time after time. They said mountains were swallowed up and hills disappeared before them, as a part of the history of what transpired even in that period of our own colonial history. So in the instance of the Indians, when Columbus arrived, he called everybody Indians because he was sailing for India, and he thought when he hit the North American continent, though fortunately for us he hit the Indies, why he thought he had arrived in India. Someone said, why was it fortunate? Well, there's one thing about the Indies and about the pattern of it. Spain, of course, was the tribe of Simeon. And whereas they were to be explorers, and they were also known because of the fact that Simeon, the scripture says, which was one of the houses of your race, and when Jacob gave his blessing for Simeon, which is the Spanish people, he said he would be one of these explorers, all right. But he said that Simeon also was known as cruel, and he never was deterred from his objectives. But the fact is that Spain controlled the Indies for years, and due to the fact that its religious impact has been under the control of great areas of superstition, the areas which the Spanish settled in the Indies and the Caribbean never advanced as far as the areas that were colonized by the Anglo-Saxon and Nordic areas of colonization. Now we point out that when Columbus arrived, of course, why these people, he thought, were the peoples of India, and the name has stuck to them ever since. It's a rather significant thing that some 1,200 years ago, there had been migrations out of Scandinavia. The great ships of the Norsemen with their great dragon heads and their great eagle heads had spanned courageously the Atlantic Ocean. They sailed across the Northern Passage. They had passed Iceland and Greenland and finally hit Canada and sailed up the St. Lawrence River. They had sent expeditions out over the land. And in the many instances, they immediately decided that they would build stockades in small cities. There was apparently some 12 migrations of these ships that sailed into the setting sun from Scandinavia, which fact only demonstrates their Israelitish origin, but like Manasseh, that had gone out 800 years before the time of Christ, or part of it, they also, going westward, had had their impact. In fact, some of them managed to return to tell the story so that more ships came out, but some of them stayed. They built their stockades, they set up their cities, they actually, along the Great Lakes, set up foundries, which we find the remnants of today. In these foundries, they melted iron ore, which they found around the Great Lakes, and they beat themselves great new axes, battle axes, and mighty swords. It is a part of the history of how the Indians were amazed when they saw these Norsemen, when they saw their great blades of iron, and they saw their swords and their weapons. In fact, they lay siege to some of these cities, and they were unable to conquer these Norsemen in open battle, but with their arrows and with their numbers, why they would snipe them as they came out of the cities for supplies of material. When winter was coming and they saw in one instance they couldn't return, one of these cities took their great dragon ships, which were, of course, manned by many oarsmen and sails, and they opened up the petcocks, they filled them with rocks and sank them in the clear water of the St. Lawrence River. They intended to raise them in the spring and go back, but by sinking them thus, they wouldn't be injured, nobody could disturb them, and so they sank them in the water. Well, the whole colony was wiped out by Indians, and those ships were never raised until just a few years ago, when archaeologists discovered them up there and raised them, and some of those ships are today in perfect preservation, though they were underwater for almost 1,200 years. Now, among the waves of these who came, realizing now that they couldn't stand against the great new syndicates of Indians that were joining, or the Asiatic Indians and Mongol tribes, which reached out into the Plains Indians, had now joined to attack these northern cities of the Norsemen. Long before the days of the English colonies, long before the days of Columbus, and of course their struggle was intense. So the Indians didn't fight at night, and the ancient records, which were a part of the history of the Delawares and the Mohicans and the Powhatans, of which of course the Narragansetts and even Pocahontas comes, they were a part of the people that went nomad. They left their cities at night. They marched as bands out into the forest. They went tribal so their society could become more fluid. That existed in the years that followed, a society then of a people who came to build a civilization like they had at home, who intended to live as their Norse backgrounds had indicated, but they couldn't do it. Their cities were ruined. They were forced into what you might call nomadic semi-savagery. But they did retain concepts of the Great Spirit. They did retain the symbols and the stories and the records. And thus they had much of the Old Testament concepts of history, especially as we see the same traditions with them in their theology as existed in Northern Europe at the impact and prior to the impact of Christianity's great expansion in Scandinavia. It's a rather interesting thing to note that the Mohicans, the Delawares, were totally white tribes, the Narragansetts, the Seneca, and a great number of tribes, which we will not name tonight because of the time factor involved, and many of them, sub-tribes out of these tribes, were white people. But they had gone native, and as such, in their natives, their skin became tan, but it was always noted with this particular group of Indians, like the Delawares especially, when the treaties were made with them, that as they threw back their tunics, that their chest was as white as the white settlers with whom they made their agreements. And after Pocahontas had been the bride of John Smith and was taken to the court of England, her blue eyes and her fair hair and her skin soon became as white as those of the court. And to the amazement of all about, they said, well, this woman must have come from white people, which, of course, was a part of the impact of your race. The impact of your race, that is, especially the Adamic race, has not been too old, as we know, upon this continent. 800 B.C., and again at a period of 1,200 years ago, and then followed up by the later settling that brought the English, and it brought the Scandinavians, and the Germans, and the French, and the Spanish to North America, which contemporary history you know about with the colonization of these United States. It's a rather significant thing, however, that in the South, the great strength of this white leadership had remained. At one time, remember, Austria had decided to build a great dynasty down in Mexico, and of course, in the days of Montezuma, they were going to establish the aristocracy of Austria virtually in Mexico and rule over it. They almost made it for a while, but the history of the events that transpired can belong to a contemporary era, but they were sitting on the remnants of an ancient society. A people ruled by a flying deity in their thinking, Quetzalcoatl, the great flying serpent, and the worship of Quetzalcoatl is the worship of all of the symbolisms of the rebellious deity or the Luciferian force. We point out that the impact of the white man was tremendous. And in the stories of the Tulapek, we find that the Mongol Tartars that marched down across the steppes and came into America and fought their way south wanted these rich golden cities. They waged war with a new type of gas warfare. They knew about sulfur and how to use it, and the fumes of sulfur choked many of the Mayas. The Mayan cities were great prizes, but they also had entrances and exits that were not the upper gates. And so as the war parties of these Tartar Mongols that had now moved their way across, shall we say Tungus Mongols, across the steppes and down into America, were after these great prizes. They eventually captured the old Mayan cities, though many of them died in the situations above. The great number of these white leaders and their peoples came up into Mexico and into southern United States. If you check into the background of these histories of the Indian tribes, you'll find something interesting. The white tribes retained more their identity as white men, refusing to integrate, than did other Indian tribes that integrated back and forth. There were tan Indians, they were Mongol yellow Indians, and they were Indians of reddish color. Now, this means three kinds of peoples from the ancient continents were roaming this continent and from the areas of Asia, together with some that may have been native here, but which would go back to the original builders of the high civilizations of the southern continent. Rather interesting to note, then, that the Cherokees, for instance, they were whole tribes of white Cherokees. In fact, the white Cherokee did somewhat blend into the Indian Cherokee of the Asiatic seed to some extent. But even that area of Cherokee was more brilliant than many of the surrounding tribes. In fact, the Cherokees made various trips and made contact with rulers inside of Europe, as well as they were representing themselves constantly before our own government. And they were quite intelligent, and they were able to write both their own languages, but they wrote very quickly our languages. Now, the white Cherokee is a white man descended from Manasseh. The other Cherokees are blended in race, color, and background, but they were an Asiatic. There are white Apache, and there are Asiatic Apache, and this can be determined by phrenology and the high cheekbones, the slanting eyes. But the white Apache were a part of civilizations that had great cities at one time existed before the wars of the Tartars. There are cities which are beneath the ground today because of catastrophes that did happen, and some of them built into the cliffs, and some of them built in lower levels along canyon walls. These were done, of course, to preserve themselves in the battles and the fighting that surrounded the periods of thousands of years of American history before the white man. There exists up where the Nez Perce existed. There was white Nez Perce Indians. And they were not Indians at all. They were branches of Manasseh who had gone northward and joined themselves with some of the Scandinavian blood. That's why Nez Perce weapons were the weapons of Scandinavia, with the great broad axes together with the use of the bow and the spear. It's rather significant also that the methods of fishing used by the Sioux and the Nez Perces were almost identical with Scandinavian procedures and use of fishing that was known by the Indians of the Great Lakes areas, which had definitely been imported from Europe and was not used by any other Indians anywhere in the country. So when we look out over the Iroquois, and here again we have a tribe divided into two groups, but one of the leaders of the Seven Nations, it is estimated that 25% of all of the nomadic strength of peoples that were living in the North American continent when the colonists came over from Columbus time on were white men and had descended from white areas of history. Now, along with this, there existed these various brands of Asiatic Mongol peoples. And generally speaking, the tribes' leaderships in the areas where they had formed unions was under the leadership of white tribesmen, and preeminently they showed their ability in the areas of statesmanship, in unity, and in organization. This is one of the patterns that was so well marked in some of the greatest struggles which were had in this country. The Northern Cheyenne Indians were Asiatic Indians. Their concepts and their living and even their theology was almost like that of the step riders of the ancient Tungus, almost like those that Ivar Lister talks about as he talks about the concept of the god that supplied the reindeer and how they worshipped and what the symbols were and the use of the emblem of the bear and so forth, found exactly the same among these Cheyenne Indians. But when we go even farther north along the Canadian border, we find pressing their way across from the Great Lakes regions had come the impact of white men. There is a great historic conference that was held, and this conference is written in the Aztec language. It tells about the gathering of the kings, or actually the tribal chiefs, to see what they were going to do about eliminating the influence of these who were the children of the white god from influencing their theology and standing in opposition of the devils which they were seeking to propitiate. So we find the record today that there was a theological force fighting against the leadership of the white man who was still worshipped preeminently the Great Spirit who he said was his father and that they were the children of the Eternal Son. Not sun worshippers in its full form, but somewhat significant with some of the things we discussed today when we talk about the ancient emblem that Malachi talks about for you, the Son of Righteousness that will rise with healing in his wings. Every once in a while you'll find somebody said, I'm concerned because I have some Indian blood somewhere in my background. Which side am I on? Well, that's pretty hard to determine at this time, especially when you have in the land of Oklahoma two kinds of Choctaws, for instance. There was a white Choctaw whose people were white, and there was a dark Choctaw who was Asiatic, and actually, as you'll see, followed traditions Asiatic, played games. A type of ball game that was known in ancient China was one of the major favorite games of the Choctaw in Oklahoma. And yet there were white Choctaw that were forever at war with them, and of course came from that Manasseh origin. Over a period of hundreds of years, it's surprising how many people can multiply and breed from the households of those people that can live for a time in peace. And so we point out this to you. When there came out into the Cherokee Nation a great number of people that were migrating to the West, and as they migrated to the West, they came into Texas Territory, they came out into Oklahoma and the Indian Territory, they came into the land of the Cherokee Nation. Well, strangely enough, there existed then a preeminent number of white Cherokees. And these looked as white as the women that many of these pioneers had been used to. And they were a long ways from home, and they were out in a new country. And it is, generally speaking, the selection, as history proves, and the history of Oklahoma proves, that a great number of these people settling there married these white Indians, which they would talk about, many of which had blue eyes and fair hair. So again, it's a rather significant thing that we find today. There are a great number of people of Cherokee blood, of Seneca blood, of a great numbers of areas of bloods. Actually, whether they know it or not, their forebearers had tied back into a part of their own race that had been over here in its strange area of migrant mission as colonizers to a degree and as the testators of their faith and of their religion. It's a rather significant thing that this land, which we have watched grow up under the technology and the leadership of the white man, was not a new land, but an old one in prophecy. When David, for instance, was crowned and stood by his pillar, and the day that he was crowned king, the voice of God spake out unto David, and he said, David, as David was standing by his pillar, I'm going to give unto thy people, I'm going to give them a land beyond the waters, a land where they will never be moved again, a land where they're not going to be oppressed as they have been oppressed in the past. Now, he wasn't talking about Palestine because David was standing in Jerusalem by his own pillar. He was in Canaan land, and God told him about another land he was going to give to his race. A great land, a land that would never be taken from them, and a land which he had been preparing for them. Inside of the scriptures, we have the story of how God promised this land, how it was to be the land of the pine tree, the fir tree, the box tree, the myrtle wood tree. In fact, over here in the book of Isaiah, the prophecies that were made concerning this land are rather clear. In them, we see the declaration here, Behold, this is what I will do. I will take my rest, but God promised that I'm going to give unto you a land. And in this land is going to be the box tree, the pine tree, the fir tree. God tells the prophet that the cedars of Lebanon shall be there. These are the great Gadigansha trees, the redwood trees. Now, the only place where there are redwood trees, like there were in those days, in the days when we talk about the great cedars of Lebanon, the only place where there were trees like that are here in the west coast of the state of California and along our redwood highways and in our Sequoia Mountains. And this is the only place on the face of the earth outside of Palestine where the myrtlewood tree grows. And you have myrtlewood here in Oregon. And of course, there's never been a land any more blessed than we have by great pine, fir, and cedar forests. And then, of course, the 18th chapter of Isaiah, the prophet has said, hold to this great land, which will be the land of the outstretched wings of the eagle. It's westward beyond the lands of Africa, and it is looking from Jerusalem westward across the waters, a great and new and powerful nation of people. God said in that day, we would send our ambassadors by sea in water-drinking vessels. The vessels of bulrushes meant water-drinking reeds or water-drinking vessels, saying, go ye swift messengers of a nation tall and clean shaven, of a people powerful from their beginning, from this time onward, a nation surveyed and measured underfoot. We're the only first nation under the Meats and Bonds Act of our nation to measure mathematically and to set our land up in sections, north, south, east, and west, and not to sell property by landmark from tree to fence to post to rock. The scripture not only continues its measure, this is the land divided by rivers. Probably no other nation has been so blessed. More of your state lines today have been divided by rivers like the Hudson River dividing New York and New Jersey and the Mississippi River and the Ohio River and the St. Lawrence River cutting this on the north free from Canada and the Rio Grande working its way down dividing states and the Colorado River. And all over the country you will note that a great majority of even our states are divided by rivers. That we were a land overflowing with rivers, a land of bounty, and so forth. And so God gives his measure. All ye inhabitants of the world, all ye dwellers in the earth, see this nation when it lifts up its standard and its ensign. There is no doubt about the plans for America. I turn over in Jeremiah, and God told Jeremiah concerning this. He said, behold, I'm going to bring Israel out of its captivity into its dwelling places. One of the things that's going to happen, he was going to give us a great land. And out of the people dwelling in this land was going to proceed the voice of thanksgiving and the voice of them that make merry. And I'm going to multiply them, and they're not going to be a few. And I'm going to glory in them, and they shall not be small. And the emblem of the glory of God is upon our national seal. And the outstretched wings of that eagle of the 18th chapter of Isaiah is upon our national seal. And the ideal symbol of the messianic building of that great pyramid and altar that our forefathers built in the land of Egypt is upon that seal. And that, of course, is the 72 covenanted stone symbol of the great pyramid of Giza. And overhead is the all-seeing eye, and it's set in the great capstone. And this was the emblem that was carried into Egypt by Enoch and Job when they built the great city of On. And it was also one of the emblems known to the ancients as the emblem of the all-seeing eye of the God that created the heavens and the earth. Rather significant then that the prophecies which God made concerning this land, and when we were blessed and when we had thanksgiving because of our freedom, our rulers and our governors were going to be of ourselves. And it's been that way up until lately. And we still may say that some of these rulers have been in ourselves, but we sure got a sorry bunch of advisors around them. They look like the same scurvy scum that gave trouble in the days of Rehoboam, when instead of being led by the elders of Israel, it was by the Canaanites and the apostates that came in that the kingdom knew its judgments. No doubt we're in a latter period of a time of trouble, but anyhow, we have been a people with a voice of thanksgiving. We're one of the first nations officially to proclaim a Thanksgiving Day that we might give thanks unto God for the bounty of the harvest. And, of course, our great Anglo-Saxon forebearers, when they first landed at Plymouth Rock, one of the first things they did is set aside the day for Thanksgiving, for their safe arrival. God said, "Ye shall be my people, and I'll be your God. This is what I've promised. And I'm going to cause this people to continue to draw near unto me." Yes, we are in the land that God promised to the house of Joseph. The kind of a land where we would be blessed by mineral wealth, we'd be blessed by the values of oil, and by the technology that enabled us to recover it. All of these things related to this nation. Here we are, a great nation, to be the one people out of the many. Our language follows the language of the Angles. We speak the English language, and we as a great nation still are under the emblem of the outstretched wings of the eagle. We still have our governors selected of ourselves, and our great problem is to drive away the pagan advisors that are seeking to destroy our greatness. Someone said, "What of America's future?" America's future is in the hands of our Father, whose spiritual force is stirring up to his many sons, is going to use you to help lead all the white men of earth for the great triumph of God's kingdom. And I'm going to tell you, my friends, that the hordes that tried to swallow us up when they hit the Mayan cities, the hordes that fought us in tribal warfare, the hordes that decided that we couldn't have any part of this continent and eventually have lost that power. Oh, you say it was a terrible thing. We killed off the buffalo so that the roaming pantry of the Indian was destroyed. It doesn't make any difference, my friends. We were occupying under destiny, and this great nation was to grow. The most intelligent way to eliminate a powerful enemy was to cut off his mobile food supply and keep forcing him back out of the areas that we wanted to occupy. We occupied America. This is the great land of these United States. We're not about to give it back to anybody, and we're not about to have it absorbed by the enemies of God's kingdom. We're going to rise, we're going to fight, we're going to take America back. This great nation is going to see the mighty visitation of the Most High God and the great relocation of a great new order as God puts his new Jerusalem upon the face of the earth. And it's all hidden in your symbolism, and it's all hidden in the prophecies concerning this nation. And this is going to be a good place to be. It truly is rightfully said when we say this is God's country and this is God's land. America's future is going to be one of purity. It's going to be one in which this shall be one of the great headquarters of God's kingdom. In fact, my friends, we will have Palestine all reassembled, rejuvenated as a historical monument, but there won't be room enough for all the people that make up the household of that kingdom down there. This is the spot that God has ordained.
We pray that your spiritual ears have received today's message and that you are fed with strong meat relevant to solving the needs of our nation and Christian civilization everywhere. Herald of Truth is sponsored by Kingdom Identity Ministries through the financial support and prayers of listeners like you who love the truth of God's Word and want to see it broadcast throughout the land to awaken His people. If you would like a
CD
of today's message, tell us the date and station to which you are listening and send a donation to cover our cost plus help with radio time to Kingdom Identity Ministries, Post Office Box 1021, Harrison, Arkansas, 72602. We would appreciate donations made by our international listeners to be in U.S. funds. For a free introductory packet of information, including our doctrinal statement of beliefs, plus lists of books and tapes to aid you in your study of biblical truth, write Kingdom Identity Ministries, Post Office Box 1021, Harrison, Arkansas, 72602, USA. Or request this material by calling 870-741-1119. That's 870-741-1119. Visit our internet website by going to www.kingidentity.com. Type www.kingidentity.com. We invite you to listen regularly to Herald of Truth broadcast for more dynamic messages proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom at this same time and station.